I was born questioning everything that I was told by my parents, by my school, by the church, but, you know, by the press, who were like, really, this is true? I've tried to eke out a life not compromising on my beliefs and on my principles, which has not been difficult. Which has not been easy at all. I've done anti-fracking protests, which is really much more my kind of thing than journalism. Journalism always seeks out the grey, doesn't it? You have two sides and you try and find middle ground in that, and that's really just not me at all. Increasingly, as I got older, I just became a much more black and white person. Like, this is my truth, and there is no compromise on that.
But I would agree, and, you know, which is why I sort of drifted towards campaigning journalism, where you're saying actually there is an official and lots of money behind an official narrative, and what I'm interested in is the opposition, which is we're increasingly seeing, well, we're seeing less and less and less of the balance in our mainstream press. But I mean, what you're talking about there is fascinating to me. It's a kind of guilt tripping and emotional blackmail that you think, you know, you push back against that. And I think all people with real integrity do, because many of us, I think, you know, as we embark on our careers, on our relationships, etc., there's a lot of emotional blackmail going on trying to push us down a certain route, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the voice of wisdom, the voice of reason, that was always my father, was, you know, forever trying to impress on me, like, if you want to change things, you should join it. If you don't agree with the politics, you should join a political party and try and change the system from within. And, that may be the voice of reason, but it's just not the reality as I see it. You know, the change always comes from the margins. It never comes from within. The system is now such a bulwark of military industrial media pharma complex. How is a single voice, or you know, even the few voices that we are who see a different truth from the mainstream, how are we going to make a dent in that? Or I don't see that at all. It's got to come from the outside.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, you're right about political parties. Anybody that joins them with any kind of ideals soon gets those ideals bashed out of them. And there's so much horse trading going on all the time. It's like a kind of plea bargaining system. Yes, you can progress through the party, you can have some influence, but only if. And then the emotional blackmail starts. And, you know, so you're absolutely right about that. It's a deterioration, I think, really, in civil society that most of us have witnessed since the war.
If you look at the Dutch Farmers Party, the BBB, that won really big in the most recent upper house elections, and everybody was over the moon, like, yay, the farmers have won, and, you know, this is a victory for democracy. And then it turns out the farmers have actually bought into the nitrogen narrative, that the very narrative that the government is bashing the farmers with. So everybody feels incredibly let down by them, and they are now in government for the next 4 years. You know, so every time there's a little bit of hope, like I remember when Obama won the elections, when was that, 2004 or something, I was over the moon, like, yay, this is a really good guy. And in no time at all, it just turns out to be more of the same.
Well, you do wonder, don't you, if these things are deliberately set up almost to sort of capture the public mood and then to be locked down. There's something, or maybe, I mean, even things like blackmail may be going on. I certainly think that's a lot of what a lot of this child abuse is about. It's about compromising people so that they can be easily blackmailed. I mean, there's not a lot you can do if you know, there's been some sort of compromising behavior. But anyway, I mean, we've got this enormous changes going on, particularly with the zero carbon agenda. And I think, in a way, the Dutch have been at the forefront of this with the imposition of changes. I can remember it's a very, very memorable slogan painted on one of the tractors, which is "No farmers, no food." So what is actually going on? Because I think we're here in Britain, many of our farmers are looking over at Holland in horror, thinking, where next?
Well, in the UK, the farmers are being encouraged to take early retirement, aren't they? And their land is bought up by the state. In the USA, Bill Gates has been buying vast swathes of land, apparently during the plandemic, chamdemic. The most seriously hit ethnicity was Sioux Indians, I think, and all they're virtually wiped out, and all their reservation land has been bought by Bill Gates. Also in Ireland, there's some law. I haven't actually looked into this, but in Ireland also, the farmers are being driven off the land by some new tax law or something. So there's a massive assault on our food system, but that's been going on since maybe 1992, when the single European market came off, and Codex Alimentarius, which is a Brussels lobby group, really became quite prominent, and that attack on the food system and the healthcare system, because the two are connected, has gradually gained in strength. So if you know about Codex Alimentarius, this is just an extension of it. Also, can I say about the Dutch, no farmers, no food, the Dutch are already the biggest insect food producers in the world. And they started that program again, I think around about 2002, they started investing in cricket and grasshopper burgers and gravy and what have you. And they have now got a full insect food industry up and running. So maybe the farmers are just being replaced by a different industry and nobody actually gives a toss.
Well, I mean, I'm sure quite a lot of people do, but the interesting thing is this is a society that's actually just being managed. The whole concept of democracy, of the people having any say, seems to be have disappeared.
Yes. And I notice it, Tony, is absolutely shocking, actually. So I've just moved house and I have had to order broadband, and I've had to find a, you know, water supply, power supplier, all this kind of stuff. The whole notion of me as a customer having wishes and requirements, it's gone out the window. I just have to take it as it comes. And if it comes in 2 months' time, then, you know, there's not a sorry, there's not a... And also another thing that I notice now is, for example, British Telecom, they have a what they call a social tariff for people on low income. You have to give British Telecom, some guy in a call centre in Glasgow, you have to give him your national insurance number so that BT can check that you're legitimately on benefits. I mean, that is awful. That is Mussolini's definition of fascism. That is corporations and government in bed together. Mm.
Anyway, I mean, the reason I got hold of you was because we've had, I mean, it was, first of all, it was just in the Dutch and papers, and then in a couple of days afterwards in the English language papers, and obviously in the Russian newspapers too, Prince Bernard of the Netherlands Nazi Party membership card has been confirmed by experts as authentic. So for a while there were denials about Bernhard being a Nazi. I mean, he was a Dutch prince who spent a lot of time working with the British Army in World War II as liaison. And he was born in Germany, but he married into the Dutch royal family just before the Second World War. Mm. But it's now been absolutely proved that he was actually quite early on in there in the Nazi Party. Can you tell us a bit about what this means?
Well, we already knew that he was a lying scumbag. Is what it means formally is
I mean, because the first time I ever remember coming across Bernhard was the 1975 Lockheed scandal, where he'd taken a bribe. And I remember last time we spoke to you, you had actually been, by some amazing coincidence, working in a Dutch newsroom at the time.
Yes, yes. And my boss, broke that scandal in the Dutch press. He just got the proof that so there had been rumours that a highly placed Dutch official had taken bribes, because in America there was a there was an investigation into bribing tactics, bribery by large corporations such as Northrop and Lockheed, aeroplane manufacturer. And during that investigation, it was mentioned that a highly placed Dutch official had received serious sums of money. And then in The Hague, there were whispers that it would be Bernard von Lippe-Biesterfeld, the queen consort. And so my boss actually broke that scandal. He got the proof that it was indeed Prince Bernard. So he got 1.1 million from Lockheed. And I think it was later found that he also got money from Northrop. I'm not quite sure who Northrop are, but they're also a big name. Bernard's also, he's got a string of illegitimate children, some in America, some in France, some in Africa. He paid for a private army in Tanzania, supposedly to protect big game. In reality, his army got involved in the ivory trade. The whole World Wildlife Fund connection is all, everything's dodgy about this man. In fact, a Dutch author wrote a book saying nothing is what it seemed. That's the title of the book. Nothing is what it, nothing is as it seems.
Well, that's
even during the war, when he cast himself as this, head of the Dutch armed forces or head of the resistance, he cast himself as this kind of, I always forget the name of. Well, who's the Brit, the aeroplane, the man with the white scarf and the leather helmet? What's his name? Biggles. Oh. Yeah. He cast himself as this kind of Biggles, you know, kind of riding in there, knight in shining white armor. And it's just not the truth at all of who he was and how he was.
For me is what happened with the Dutch royal family, because I know at the beginning of the war, I think it's at Queen Wilhelmina. It was her daughter that married Bernhard, but she she fled the country. And what was her, you know, advice to the Dutch to fight the Nazis who were occupying Holland at that point?
Well, no. So initially, she was in, Wilhelmina was in London with her entire government and all of her wealth, which she somehow, you know, managed to smuggle out. I mean, like, can you imagine if Prince Charles had to get all of his wealth together? That would take a fair bit, wouldn't it? All the Da Vinci's and the Picasso's and what have you. But somehow Wilhelmina managed to get all of her 40 million guilders worth of wealth out of the country overnight. So they must have been ready. So she was in London with her government. Juliana and her children, so that's the future Queen Beatrix and her siblings, they had gone to Canada to keep the crown princess out of harm's way. And Bernard stayed in London, as I said, as head of the resistance and what have you. But Wilhelmina actually went, so there was radio, I think it was just called Radio Orange. She called on the Dutch up until 1943. She called on the Dutch to collaborate with the Germans, lest the infrastructure be damaged and, just collaborate, do as they say and leave the country, you know, thriving and what have you. Meanwhile, I have a very serious hunch that Bernard actually played both sides, that his, obviously his, although in Germany he was cast as a traitor, and so was his brother. His brother was even kicked out of the army. I mean, totally disgraced. The entire family were disgraced. But I reckon that Bernard actually, as liaison, acted as liaison between the Allied and the Germans, and brokered a deal. And if you know that the bank that mostly funded the whole war machinery had the Bush family involved, you know, there was massive American corporate interest in wartime Germany. They all wanted the same thing. They all just wanted money, they wanted power, they wanted control. So I think they just convinced the Germans to down their weapons, get rid of Hitler because Hitler was the bad guy, but everything else could stay the same and evolve into the EU. And that's what we're seeing. The EU is actually the Fourth Reich. It's the Third Reich minus the weapons. Well, that's how I see it anyway.
Well, no, me too. I mean, I think what they did is they created an economic Fourth Reich. In fact, in my book, I show and recount a story where an army officer who was escorting Nuremberg Nazi officers who were on trial says that he was told by them, you know, he said, so now you have beaten us for the second time, but the next time we will win. And you won't know what's happening until it's all over.
Yeah.
So there is quite a lot of evidence that there was always a plan to take the loot of Europe after the war and create this kind of economic empire. But I mean, it does. One of the things that I dug up about Bernhard was that the Americans didn't trust him in the Second World War, and yet the British did. I mean, here we have an ex-Nazi who is basically seeing himself as in charge of the Dutch resistance during the liberation of Holland, and yet the British army decided they wanted to trust him. I mean, surely they must have known that he was a former Nazi. There are photographs around of him.
Yes.
And I mean, they knew that he was a German aristocrat who was around in Germany and was helping the rise to power of Hitler even after the Nazi Party had been taken power.
Yes. Also, the Dutch government is quite clear from telegrams, cables, did they call them cables, wires, that the Dutch government also knew that he was a Nazi and that he was indeed. And then this is not totally new, this story that's in the media now of his Nazi Party membership card having been found, because a copy of it was found a few years ago in America, wasn't it, in American archives. So it's always known. And Bernhard, actually, he swore with his hand on the Bible that he was never a member of the NSDAP. Hand on the Bible, I swear I was never a member. You know, like, where do you go from there?
Well, just difficult to know. Anyway, what do you make of the? I mean, at the time, surely Dutch people, this is during the war, many of them would have not trusted him. I wonder if there was a kind of an understanding that maybe during the war it wasn't a great idea for the big protector of the country to have been a former German aristocrat. And you know, there was also this whole business of. After the war, I mean, I've heard from Dutch people who were amazed that literally a week after the end of the Second World War, there were big German cars driving through Holland, you know, with industrialists getting ready to rebuild everything.
Yes, absolutely. So this was also, you just mentioned Nuremberg trials. The industrialists actually got off really light or completely in the Nuremberg trials. So the bank that I just mentioned was called, there was a bank in Rotterdam, there was a bank in New York, which was the Union Bank or something. The bank in Holland was called the Bank for Trade and Shipping. And then there was the German branch. So there were three banks that all just sluiced all their money from one to the other. Wherever people looked to investigate, the money wasn't there. So the Tyson family, who owned that bank and who basically, you know, got earned billions, literally billions in those days, even making all the steel. They were steel magnates and owned the bank. So they made all the tanks and the aeroplanes and everything went through their company. They got off altogether, you know, and it's no accident. And the Americans, in fact, I was trying to, I can't remember the names now, but in fact, the very people who ran the Nuremberg trials were actually on the board of directors of this bank. So it's just sheer unbelievable. I mean, it's the kind of stuff that we're seeing now with, you know, Bill Gates owning the World Health Organization. Basically, it's that same kind of collusion already in Nuremberg. So how could we ever have? But it was all smoke and mirrors, wasn't it? It was all a mirage of justice that was meted out that convinced the people of Europe that we were rebuilding a world rather than having more of the same.
Yeah, and many of the people who were collaborators never even, their faces never even popped up at the Nuremberg trials. So how do the Dutch people view their royal family? I mean, it does look as if the royal family are responsible for some. I mean, for example, the hunger winter 1944-1945 was absolutely horrific because there was just no food around at all in Holland, and people were starving. And that was largely due to the actions of their prince.
And queen. So in 1943, if I remember correctly, when the tide was turning, so the Allied were doing this two-pronged invasion of Europe, one coming up through Italy and the other, obviously, the D-Day landings in June 44. So there's these two prongs heading for Berlin. And when the tide was definitely turning, Wilhelmina then called on the Dutch people to start resisting. Now resist, now resist. And they did. The Dutch railways went on strike, all kinds of other, you know, big organizations that the country depended on, the banks, whatever, everything went on strike and started resisting. And the Germans retaliated horrifically. Also, by this time, they were actually running out of food and fuel. So they just took absolutely everything. And this is when they really started to round up the Jews, when they really started to round up young Dutchmen to go and cut peat in Germany for fuel. So the payback for the Queen's call to arms was horrendous, and literally in the east of Holland and the north, my family, my dad and my mum, they went north to Friesland, and there was plenty of food there. It was rich farming country, but the people who lived in the cities in Rotterdam and Amsterdam, The Hague, they were eating rats and tulip bulbs and absolutely anything they could get their hands on. They were trading Picassos and Rembrandts for, you know, a pram full of potatoes. It was terrible. Well,
you do wonder if there are some echoes today with this, you know, control of the food supply, for goodness sake. But anyway, I mean, a lot of people will be listening to this thinking, or some might, thinking, well, why is this relevant today? why is this relevant today?
Well, the whole thing is obviously is very relevant. You ask me how the Dutch would have viewed a German running their resistance movement during the war. Well, the Dutch are really religious. I think something like 78% of Dutch people are church going. That is huge, you know, it's like way higher number than in the UK. And of course, the head of the church is the monarch. So Wilhelmina, Juliana, Beatrix, and currently Willem Alexander. And in the particular branch of Protestantism that, you know, it's called DP in South Africa, isn't it? It's the DP Bible. You do not question the monarch. It's actually sinful to question anything. So you just obey blindly. And if the queen marries a German, then, you know, you obey. And that's very much reflected in today's world. You do not question. I read in a Dutch on a Dutch news site that the support for the royal family fell during the pandemic. During the pandemic, when everybody was locked down and having to stay at home, William Alexander and Maxima, and you know, don't get me started on Maxima, they actually went on holidays in Greece. So ever since, the support for the royal family has fallen to something like 25% of the population now. And mostly people just say, oh, just go, you're an anachronism, you're no longer needed or wanted here. And the whole their whole entitled, well, I don't think anybody's entitled to be a monarch or to be above anybody else. I believe everybody's equal, but in particular the Dutch royal family's claim to the monarchy is very spurious. You know, right from the beginning, when we had the Republic of the Seven Netherlands, the Seven United Republics or something, and then all of a sudden there's this guy who calls himself a stadthouder, which is a city holder. There's no clear definition of this role. There's no kind of knowing where his wealth or title came from, other than the County of Orange, of course, in France, and Nassau. But all these things are like, what does this mean? And in any event, in the time of Napoleon, the Dutch had called a republic. They got rid of the monarch, and it was a republic in 1795. Then, so the Dutch actually fought on the side of Napoleon at Waterloo. The Dutch people fought with Napoleon, and William of Orange fought with Wellington and all the rest of them, and they happened to win, and all of a sudden this king is back that nobody wanted, you know, end of the Republic. And the same happened after the Second World War. The Dutch were absolutely furious that their queen or that their royal family had fled. Like, you know, you don't do that, do you? You stay with your people. And then after the war, as you said, they came back and without any election just took back the helm and resumed. And that's completely unconstitutional. So there are a lot of people now, much as in the UK, people are calling for common law tenets and to be applied again. So in the Netherlands, people are saying, well, we're actually formally a republic because the monarch forfeited the monarchy by returning and not calling an election. So it's all a mess, isn't it, Tony? We live in a big mess.
Well, I mean, I think there is, you know, there certainly is a movement against the monarchy here, which was, you know, we've just had the Republic campaigners who were all arrested in a very draconian fashion at the time of the Charles III's coronation, all just told, well, actually, you know, we're not going to charge you, you didn't commit any offences. So this is, you know, totally corrupt. But maybe, you know, you touched on it there. Could you say something about the orange thing, the Orange Order? Because this is something I don't quite understand, and maybe you can help me, because we've got in Northern Ireland, we've got this kind of Orange Order, and they are big, big enthusiasts for King Billy. And he basically came along after the restoration of the monarchy after the English Civil War with Charles II on the throne. Well, once Charles was out of the way, then suddenly the Orange Order turns up on the doorstep, the Dutch turn up. So who are these orange people?
Didn't he come into the UK? It come into England via Mary, so the era of William and Mary. Am I wrong? Am I right?
No, that's right. Yeah,
is
that's
the
right.
Same William? But I mean,
it was called the Glorious Revolution, but it was a sort of coup, basically.
Well, that doesn't surprise me at all. So, is that the same William that was in Ireland and opened? What did he do? He opened the gates of Dublin or Belfast to the invading English army. Isn't that why he's so liked? Anyway, so yeah, he was actually in exile, I think, during this time of Napoleon. Well, if it is a different William, I'm not quite sure. It gets very confusing.
Oh, no, he was around before Napoleon. But anyway, I just wonder what you make of the Orange Order. What, I mean, is it? I mean, it does seem to originate in Holland. I don't know if you know much about it, because I don't.
No, I don't either.
Okay, well, fair enough. Because it is a secret society, so of course they don't want anyone to know much about it. They're very Masonic. I mean, when I lived over in Northern Ireland, it's a peculiar kind of group of very. They seem to be sort of quite weak-minded, weak-willed people, but they like to be part of the club, you know, and it's very, very similar to Freemasonry. Just looking at the state of the world today, I mean, we've got this bizarre kind of techno-revolution going on, where we're being told that actually computers are better at sorting things out than human beings are, so we're gonna have to do what we're told by computers now, and we're gonna have human 2.0, where you know, with all this genetic engineering, these mRNA vaccines are part of this. The idea is that we can actually engineer humanity to be better. There's also a lot going on in the field of energy, where coal is now evil. And, you know, we're supposed to be using nuclear power, which is amazing to see, for example, the Scottish Greens saying, well, we need to extend the life of these nuclear power stations and we need to get rid of coal because nuclear is better or something. So what do you make of the, you know, this new vision that there is for the world, which doesn't really seem to be asking human beings, us, you know, citizens, anything really? They've just decided this is where you're going.
Yeah, I don't think this is new, Tony. How can I describe this in coherent terms? So, my entire life. So, other than a journalist, I've also been a pharmaceutical translator. You know, biomedical pharmaceutical translator, and I was onto scandals. Public health scandals quite often a long time before the journalists even had it together, because I was translating it and I knew the data wouldn't add up. Also, you know, the whole argument about genetically modified organisms, the whole story about the Second World War not being true. So there were all these loose, disjointed kind of acknowledgements of, no, this isn't right, this isn't what it seems. And I could never quite cast it into a single jacket, a single coherent story of why each of those narratives was false, until I saw a very interesting talk by Matthias Rath, and you and I have spoken about him. He's a kind of German David Icke minus the lizard stories. Who details in a very well researched talk called The EU, A Political Perspective, he details how actually since the discovery of salicylic acid and the patenting of it, the whole petrochemical pharma complex, because they are one and the same, has set out to own life itself, literally life itself. If you can patent something, you own it. So now all of a sudden I understand that genetically modified organisms, much as crops, much as there is abundant proof that the yield is much worse than in permaculture, that it's much worse for the environment, etc., etc., it's not at all about all the marketing that we've received about GMO. No, it's about the ownership of the food. And so where we are now is literally just an extension of that. It's the ownership of the human being through this, whatever has been injected into people, the mRNA. They have actually forfeited, I think, the right to their DNA to the pharmaceutical companies. I think that's what the vaccination driver has been.
Well, I mean, it's been, yes, I mean, sense. I think a fantastic amount of injuries to people, which isn't really being talked about, is very embarrassing. I mean, for example, we had a horrific coach crash recently up in Liverpool, where the driver, 40 years old, just suffered a medical episode at the wheel and turned over the coach. Initially, the press, now I'm assuming this is the Merseyside Police press office, actually lied and said another car was involved. It wasn't. The guy just had either a stroke or a heart attack at the wheel. Now, this is becoming more and more common, even children, you know, suddenly just dying because it may be because of the of these jabs. So, you know, this seems to be this bizarre world we're being pushed into. So Matthias Rath, I think, has, you know, what you've described there is making a lot of sense to me. And also there's this guy called Greg Lance Watkins over in Chepstow who dug out some fascinating documents showing something called the Europäische Wirtschaftsgemeinschaft, that the European Union was actually drawn up in 1941 by the finance officers of the Nazi Party, saying that that's what they wanted in order to run occupied Europe. And of course, they included Britain. They did at that point, they intended to invade Britain with Operation Sea Lion. So it does seem to me that that this has all got roots. And a lot of this stuff we're seeing now goes back to World War II, maybe even, you know, this is the latest manifestation of the same force that the world was fighting back then.
Yes, I think so too. So the goal of this of IG Farben, which was the main driver, wasn't it, behind the war, was to have a united, to have a one world government, actually, ultimately, you know, with one set of rules for the entire world, to have particularly one patent office, a single patent office where all these ownership documents could be lodged, to have a single currency, and preferably also to have everybody speak the same language. Well, how many of those have come true?
This is all a bit dark, what we're talking about. Do you see anything positive coming out of all this? Or is it just, are we all going to hell in a handbasket and all we can do is cross our fingers and run in the opposite direction?
Well, Tony, I was in France earlier this year trying to buy some land for my self-sufficiency project, because that's what I've been steering towards, to learn lots and lots of skills and to end up as a, you know, a person who's self-sufficient for water power and food as much as possible. And I met four young Dutch kids. Initially, I was very suspicious because I thought they were probably weed growers. But they were not. They were fantastic. Four young Dutch people, about 25 years old. And between the four of them, they had bought a farm and they were living completely off grid and completely naturally in this big permaculture project, planting trees and living as a very small community. And I was so unbelievably impressed by how clued up they were about the world, how they had clearly seen through all the BS, and they were attempting their own path. And this is so hopeful. You know, this is where my hope lies, is young people actually seeking out different paths. And it's not easy for them because all their parents, all their friends, relatives in the Netherlands all say, why can't you just come back to the Netherlands and get a job like everybody else and live like everybody else? So they really, you know, are making some sacrifices, but they're doing it.
Well, that's, I mean, it's amazing to hear. And in a way, this has got to be the solution, hasn't it? Because we've been brought up in these big cities, mainly with an industrial economy right across Europe. I mean, the Brits were the first, but I mean, all over Europe, the cities have been the thing. And it might be that these Dutch four people are almost at the vanguard of a kind of people's solution to the end of the industrial era.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So here in Britain, we of course have the travelling community and increasingly people who live in vans because, well, first of all, they can't afford to live in houses anymore, but also because of the freedom that it brings. You know, you work from your van, you have no overheads, and you just enjoy a life of foraging and living outdoors. And these people are much happier. And this is, you know, there's quite a movement, actually, quite an undercurrent of people who are opting out. So that's where my hope lies, certainly.
When the official institutions, whether it's government, church, universities, run out of ideas, that actually ordinary people have got their own solutions, and they say, well, actually, we don't need all these institutions anymore, maybe.
Well, yeah, I wish that was a louder voice there, Tony. I go to a lot of these, you know, freedom fests, if you like, or the big marches in London and the gatherings of people who would like to build a different world. And there are very few people, and even, you know, the people who've come out of the pandemic, like Mike Yaden and Dr. Tess Laurie, and, you know, all the big names that were voices during the pandemic calling for truth and honesty, they can't seem to see any political system other than the one we have. They can't seem to see. So they're setting up new parties, new political parties, with the best will in the world, you know, trying to be something pure, something that has integrity. We've already talked about this. It's not going to happen. We need to radically overhaul the system, and we need to make a direct democracy. You know, we have all the technology. This is the bizarre thing. We have all the technology to have a referendum system, or to there's a particular form of direct democracy that's called sortition. That's basically people's assemblies, and the people are called up like as if they they're called up for jury duty. So it's completely randomized, and people come together and they make big decisions. And it's like this that, for example, in Ireland, the question of abortion was sorted by people. The politicians couldn't do it. The people did it, and their recommendation was put into law. In Cuba, I've seen, you know, much as people think of Cuba as a dictatorship, I've seen just absolutely excellent examples of direct democracy, of people coming together and together discussing a particular political problem and coming up with a recommendation, and that recommendation is then acted on. Why can't we do that?
Well, you know what? It's exactly the way that Colonel Gaddafi used to do things in Libya before the West came over and nobbled him.
I was just looking into what happened to David Shaler last night, because I have a bit of a connection with the David Shaler story, you know, a bit of an obscure connection.
He's the MI5 whistleblower who, with his girlfriend Annie Machon, blew the whistle on the Gaddafi plot, isn't he, back in the 1990s?
Exactly. And my house, bizarrely, my house in Leicester was actually raided, I'm convinced, by Special Branch, because a girl, a journalism student who was in touch with Shaler, had sent me some documents in German to have a look at. And next thing I know, these weird people kind of raid my house. And I'm still, to this day, I will forever be convinced that was Special Branch, actually. You know, because this girl, this student girl, she was lifted out of bed in the middle of the night, her computer seized, she was charged with breach of the Official Secrets Act. And I was connected with her online. So, yeah, that was my connection. Anyway, I just looked up, you mentioned Gaddafi, and it just brought to mind David Shaler. Yeah.
So how do people follow you, or do you do much? You have a blog or anything like that, Millie?
Oh, I should do, Tony. But, you know, I said I'm leaving my activism days behind. I just want to garden. I want to hit the road in my bus and forage for mushrooms and medicines. And while I'm in my bus, people come up to me and I just talk face to face to people about, you know, a different world, about a different way of living, a different way of being on this planet. And
well, you're not the only one, that's for sure, because lots of people are just rejecting, I think, a lot of the mass media, a lot of the even the social media now, and saying, well, actually, let's just get down and do practical stuff, which is exactly what you're doing. So anyway, thank you very much once more for joining us.
Yeah, if people see my jungle bus anywhere, do feel free to come up to me, say hi. There's only one in the entire world, I think. So it's a big Mercedes Vario painted with Latin American rainforest. And yeah, come say hi, have a cup of tea, and set the world to rights.
This is the quiet revolution that you're part of. So thanks very much for your time again.
Well, thanks for having me, Tony.